So thank you, Sam and Scott, for the invitation. So this will be a little bit of a different take. That was a great talk that we just saw. And this is going to be from a pedagogic perspective of using energy and mass transfer that we can extract from some of these land surface models as a way to predict and understand soil forming environments. So it's a bit of a different twist. And this is work we've been, you know, fiddling around with here for a while and kind of tweaking it and improving as we move forward. And so I wanted to start and kind of give, you know, the pedagogic perspective of what we're thinking about when we're looking at soil systems of, of taking something like this. I've used this slide before, but this nice piece of deglaciated granite and under different soil forming environments producing a whole myriad of soil properties from, you know, high elevation cold systems dominated by carbon cycling to those that are wet and warm with argillic horizon formation and carbon accumulation to those that are dry and hot and really with really limited soil development. And a way to think about this is that we have an environmental forcing, and these are the energy and mass fluxes coming in from climate, primary production, sediment redistribution, that drive internal processes such as that carbon cycling and mineral weathering that then results in the evolution of these different profiles and the evolution of the soil landscape as a whole. And that these then interact with feedbacks and both positive and negative feedback systems. And all of this can be another central tenet of pedology is that all of this is driven by thinking of the pedon and the landscape as open systems that are open to both energy and mass flux. So this is, you know, a simple schematic taken from a textbook of having, you know, energy and mass flux, say, from solar radiation and evapotranspiration or mineral alteration and loss of weathering products at the pedon scale, which can also be applied to soil landscape scale, where we have this redistribution of mass and energy across the landscape as a whole. And there was some work that was in the soil science literature that was kind of, it was buried in the, I think it was the Russian Society of Soil Science Journal, and it was in Russian. You can find it translated now. Actually, there's some great work by a review paper by Manazny that kind of brought this work back to light. And it was after we had started doing some of this, and it was like, oh, look, we're doing again what's already been done. So it was truly research. But this Russian soil scientist, Volobuyev, in the late 60s and early 70s, put forward this idea of thinking of soils and soil formation as the summation of various energy and mass fluxes, including physical and chemical weathering, organic matter cycling, evapotranspiration, the leaching of solutes out of the system, as well as heat exchange between the land and the atmosphere, which over pedogenic timescales often can be neglected as you lose this out over millennia. And concurrently, there was a group of researchers, Neil Smek, and Ed actually started with work from Ed Runge, kind of taking the traditional Yenny approach and thinking of energy and mass flux and replacing that kind of standard factorial equation with energy and mass flux as those components in that system. And they took a more theoretical conceptualization of the soil system as this open thermodynamic system where you have energy and mass fluxing into the system, which drives structural organization and entropy production, which then, if exported from the system, can lead to internal organization. So they put forward this idea, or built off this idea, this was developed previously, that the total entropy change in the system is that's produced internally as well as exported externally. And the only constraint from the thermodynamic laws is that the internal entropy production has to be positive. But if you can export what is produced in the system externally, you can actually have entropy minimization within the soil system. So the idea, The idea is that if you have the soil system here and you have an energy source driving it and energy and mass flux through the system, driving this development of internal structures such as organic matter storage and cycling, exporting, you know, bringing in organic matter and then exporting CO2, that you can get internal organization of that system as long as that product from those processes is exported externally. And so they put forward this conceptual idea of, in terms of soil orders, of moving through time and increase in energy and mass flux with changes in the free energy and the entropy of the system, of of kind of going through initial materials up to ultisols, kind of being at the peak or the pinnacle of that degree of alteration and organization, and then falling back down in oxisols where you start to homogenize the system. And this is just putting those in pictures of going from this increasing weathering and subsurface organization and vertical heterogeneity, and then starting to lose some of that as we move into oxisols and highly weathered systems. And so we kind of came back, and you can put this in the same kind of framework, going back to the classic Yeni statement of soil-forming factors, and start to quantify these then as energy and mass fluxes. So kind of combining both the SMEC and the Runge and the Volovuyev approaches, where we can start to quantify, you know, delineate each of these soil-forming factors as actual components that we can quantify in a mass or energy balance framework. Again, driving these internal processes as well as the storage of energy, and then that can be measured quantitatively in terms of those products that are exported from the system. And so we can restate that soil-forming factor equation to more directly relate it to these energy and mass balance components. We're basically stating that the critical zone, or soils in this case, are a function of temperature and vapor pressure deficit, precipitation, net radiation, carbon cycling, as well as sediment production and transport. And so we can write the energy balance, or balance equations for all of these, including the energy balance with energy partition to evapotranspiration and sensible heat and heating of the soil. And from a water balance standpoint, the subsurface wetting is essentially the balance of incoming precipitation and surface runoff, as well as evapotranspiration, and that water that can be fluxed to the subsurface. And then there's net ecosystem exchange, which is the balance of gross primary production, any oxidative losses, or redistribution on the landscape through solid or solute fluxes. And then from a sediment production, if we consider a steady state system where the denudation of that landscape is equivalent to the uplift, that can be partitioned to both physical and chemical denudation. And so the easiest way to integrate all of these is to put everything into a similar unit of measure, in this case units of energy flux. And so we can convert each of these mass balance equations into an energy unit. The approach we took is that we considered the mass flux from water or base flow fluxing into the soil. We used the heat energy being fluxed into that system, assuming that it takes on the temperature of the system, which is then a representation of that net energy balance. And essentially using a reference temperature of zero, with the idea that frozen water doesn't have the potential to either transfer solutes or interact in chemical reactions. So that's an assumption there. From the biological component, we're essentially using the specific enthalpy of produced primary production to convert that mass flux of primary production into an energy unit. And this varies, of course, with vegetation type, but to make it simple, we've just selected one value that's kind of a global average of the typical chemical energy content in primary production. And then we can partition out the energy fluxes associated with denudation into those associated with sediment flux. Here is essentially the mass of sediment that can be fluxed under the force of gravity, as well as the energy associated with chemical weathering, and can be calculated as the geochemical gradient between primary and secondary phases. Right, so we can then state this, and here ignoring the sensible and ground heat flux components as over petogenic timescales become a little less relevant, and temperature is embedded in some of these components as it is. But we can sum these up as very similar to the Volovuyev statement, that the total energy is involved in soil formation is a summation of all of these parameters. And here's the catch-all to include things such as dust or anthropogenic inputs. And if you look at global averages of these components, here's the net incoming solar radiation. Of course, by far the largest component is that associated with latent heat and evapotranspiration. And then it goes in order from that associated with precipitation and biological production and then followed by sediment transport, chemical weathering, and then we did some rough estimates to get an idea of what some of these other anthropogenic or dust-type energy fluxes would add to the system. And so what comes out of this is that the two big players, aside from latent heat, are those associated with that heat transfer from precipitation, water in excess of evapotranspiration fluxing into the system, and that associated with biological production. so both a heat and a chemical energy. Flux, and so we can restate this equation, focus specifically on the subsurface with the idea that this evapotranspiration is largely that energy and mass is transferred back to the atmosphere and doesn't have the potential to perform physical or chemical work on the subsurface. And then modifying this precipitation term to recognize that it's an effective precip, or the balance of precipitation and evapotranspiration. And then we came up with this kind of clunky term that is the summation of this the heat and chemical energy flux from water and primary production. This effective energy and mass transfer term, which is a horrible acronym, EEMT. It needs something catchy. I had a colleague suggest we put the M in front, so at least it's spelled meat, which would be easier to say. But anyway, so acronyms are not my thing. So, and if we take this and we look at, say, how this is distributed on the surface of the Earth, and this is kind of we're calling now version 1.0. So this is very using simple regional climate parameters and actually using the half degree global climate data set. That was produced during from some general circulation models. We can calculate this EEMT term, and here by latitude we see, you know, a peak in the in the tropics, much as you'd expect in the hot, warm environment, that then tails off on either side, moving to the higher latitudes. And we can also plot this in climate space relative to temperature and precipitation, the more traditional ways we think about quantifying climate. And we can model that distribution with essentially a Gaussian function. What we see with, you know, in warm, wet systems, we meet the peak of energy and mass transfer, where, say, in cold, dry systems, or dry systems, period, we don't have that, water being such a key component of this energy and mass flux term. And we can also compare this to, say, the global distribution of soil orders, and it corresponds similar to the way that Smek and Runge had put forward their conceptual idea of soils evolving in response to energy and mass flux and entropy production and export, where the climatically constrained soil orders follow this from cold to hot, dry, and then moving through grasslands and with increasing moisture and energy and mass flux peaking in the oxisols. I plot entosols and inceptosols over here because these are components that are largely often constrained by landscape age. They may be in erosive environments, recent sediment deposition, or on hill slopes, and so they don't necessarily reflect the energy and mass flux in the system because they're limited by erosion or residence time. And we'll come back to that at the end of the talk. And so we applied this. So really, what we've this term, just to go back. It's a way to quantify that environmental forcing. We're not modeling process, so we're simply it's a way to integrate those soil forming factors as a forcing unit, and then we're looking in a correlative sense how that compares with soil properties and soil distribution. And so the initial place where we applied this to individual pedons, we looked at climate gradients that have been sampled along the western U.S. Going from hot, dry systems at low elevation to cool, wet systems at high elevation. And simply started plotting these various, you know, pedogenic indices relative to climate parameters here versus precipitation, where we see relatively poor correspondence to these parameters. I didn't put temperature on here, but it's essentially the same. It's more of a shotgun pattern. But when we plot these data versus this effective energy and mass transfer term, we start to see coherence in the data, where we're starting to capture more effectively, at least based on these correlations, the climatic forcing relation to individual soil properties. And again, it should be noted, this is a rate of flux relative to a static stock or property. So we're assuming that what we're measuring in the modern climate is going to correlate to something that may be the legacy of thousands of years of soil evolution. So the fact that it pops out well was surprising, but also encouraging that this unit could be an effective predictor of soil properties. As we went through and developed this, we kind of made little incremental steps along the way of tweaking this. As we wanted to, you know, we had this model output, so what we wanted to do is compare these modeled outputs with what we could measure empirically. And so we did this at the catchment scale using the set of MOPEX catchments, which have hydrologic data both on precipitation and base flow and evapotranspiration, so we have good constraint on the water balance. And then using remote sensing indices of primary production, namely the MODIS product, to get at annual rates of primary production, and then could calculate this EEMT term directly from empirical data from these catchments that have, you know, several, at least a decade, if not more, of data. And so what we found is that consistently that the model was over-predicting what we were measuring or what we quantified empirically. The encouraging thing was that they were related linearly and highly correlated, but we consistently over-predicted the energy and mass flux. And when we look at the residuals of these lines, they are most strongly correlated to quick runoff, so essentially indicating that by not including runoff in the water balance, we are overestimating the amount of water fluxing into the subsurface, as well as aspect effects, namely in primary productivity, where we're not capturing that local insulation control on primary production. And so we decided to go after that and look specifically at a derived this on a local at a climate gradient here in southern Arizona, where we're bringing in topographic controls on water redistribution, so locally modifying the water balance, as well as topographic controls on evapotranspiration and primary productivity. So this is location that should be down here. That's about where we are now. So this is the Santa Catalina Mountains, which is just outside of Tucson, which is the better city in Arizona, about an hour to our south. I'm not biased at all, though. So the University of Arizona sits down here. This is the Tucson Basin. And these are it's an uplifted metamorphic core complex with a variety of parent materials, but largely granitic in nature. And it spans a steep environmental gradient. So we go from essentially aridic thermic to hyperthermic conditions in the base to mesic and almost frigid and ustic kind of conditions at the top. So basically desert scrub up to mixed conifer, going from about 600 meters to almost over 2,500 meters. And so precipitation follows that with the orographic effects with, over almost four times as much precipitation at high elevation as at low elevation. And we have a lot of topographic complexity. This is northness, where one being steep north-facing slopes and minus one being steep south-facing slopes. So it brings in a lot of climatic and topographic variability where we can develop this. And so we took a couple off-the-shelf approaches where we used the local energy. We modified temperature based on the topographic control of incoming solar radiation. This is standard, like out of mountain climb, those types of models. And so we could get a topographically resolved variation in temperature. For the water balance, we were going after this F term, that water that can flux into the subsurface, and it needs to balance out that surface runoff. And so we use it at kind of the traditional wetness index approach, where we take into consideration catchment area and slope, but then we derive this alpha term, where we took the wetness index at each pixel and divided by the mean of the catchment, which essentially normalizes that data so that a value of 1 indicates that it gets 100% of the effective precipitation at that site. A value less than 1 indicates a loss of water to surface runoff, and values greater than 1 indicates it's gaining water from other portions of the landscape. And so we're just simply then modified that water balance with this water redistribution term. And then luckily we had access to a fantastic data set of on-the-ground measurements of above and below-ground productivity that across elevation and aspect. So we could derive a very simple empirical relation with how primary production varied with both elevation and northness. And so when we compare these two, we can see that this is the traditional approach just based on the regional climate data, and here now is the approach that starts to incorporate that topographic variation in water and energy balances in primary production. And we can see that the factors that account for the most variation in this topographically resolved EEMT term is still largely elevation, which captures this climate gradient implicit in this elevation gradient. But then follow that is aspect is the biggest component with that local modification of solar radiation and a relatively minor influence of water redistribution on the landscape. Now again, this is a semi-arid environment where we don't have a lot of water to begin with, so this might play a larger role in more humid systems. And we compared this to some independent metrics. Here is this is basically looking at elevation on the x-axis and northness, so aspect from basically steep north-facing to steep south-facing slopes. We have LIDAR data on here from this site where we can quantify the biomass based on canopy height. And so we can see, you know, the clear relation where as we go up in elevation, we have an increase in biomass. But we also see for a given elevation, you see increasing biomass for more north-facing slopes, so capturing that topographic control. And we see that we have a very similar pattern, almost identical, in the EEMT, which was essentially calculated independent of this biomass term. So it gave us some confidence that we are capturing well some of this local landscape control. And so we've also taken this and applied it in a more of a soil landscape and evolution framework, where this is a very simple, kind of the first very simple approach where we did this. We took a kind of the standard geomorphic approach of considering, you know, soil production here, this kind of max soil production term. These are soil depth terms and uplift, where you can essentially calculate soil depth with a reference depth based on the rate of soil production or the physical conversion of bedrock into transportable soil material and the local rate of tectonic uplift. And there are a couple of different ways to do that. This is the simplest representation. And we further data mined from the literature and from a publications that had good constraint from cosmogenic nuclide on production rates. We could derive a simple empirical function between production rates and effective energy and mass transfer. So essentially, as the energy and mass transfer increases, we see an exponential increase in this potential rate of soil production. And so we can play with that in model space as a means to, say, predict what we'd expect to see in terms of soil depth with increasing energy flux from precipitation and biological production, and then with decreasing, or I guess in this way, going from low to high rates of uplift. And you can see that at high rates of uplift, it doesn't really matter until you get to very high rates of EEMT that you're not producing soil fast enough to offset that which is lost to erosion. Whereas in low uplift systems, it doesn't take much energy and mass flux at all, and you start to derive relatively thick soils in those systems. And we've applied this in more complicated ways to bring in topography and local variation as well. And work currently ongoing is, again, is this EEMT term, it's a flux term. And so we've explicitly avoided and not dealt with time. And so we're going after this now with a grad student who's actually giving a five-minute, I'll give a plug, he's giving one of the five-minute talks in the Southwest Soil Landscape session this afternoon, I think. This paper is currently in review where he's essentially taken gathered all available data we can for chronosequences across the globe that have good age constraint on the age of that surface and then have a relatively complete data set in terms of soil physical properties. And looked at comparing the relative values of this term, what were total petogenic energy, which in this case it's simply taking that rate of EEMT times the relative age of that landscape. What this ignores, of course, is that for old landscapes where climate has varied, we're forcing it with a modern climate. But what he has found is that we have a very consistent relationship with this total energy input. So here is just a energy per unit area relative to, say, clay percent across these chronosequences. So now we're starting to bring in the age constraint as well as the climate flux. So we can kind of restate that soil forming equation here where we're dealing with the total petogenic energy in terms of the climatic and biologic forcing. We aren't dealing with parent material, and we're also dealing with time. And you can see that these are marked then by age of the landscape. So, of course, as things get older, they increase in clay content, but we see much better prediction of clay content with this integrated EEMT term relative to just time by itself. So climate, the energy and mass flux is still playing an important role in that clay content. And much of this spread around this line is, again, there was no constraint on parent materials. So this is everything from beach sand terraces to basalt lava flows. And so a lot of this spread around the line likely is attributable to parent material variation, as well as the fact that we're forcing this with modern climate. And as we get to older systems, these have all seen glacial, interglacial cycling, where climates would have been would have been different. But what we can do with this is we can start to play some games where we can take, you know, these geomorphic models where we can predict soil depth and residence time based on topography. We can take the topographically resolved EEMT terms and start to get, you know, this is a relatively small catchment, about 10 hectares, where we can then start to plot out, okay, we have residence time and soil depth and this topographically resolved EEMT. We can see what that would look like in the landscape. You know, the residence time is the oldest here, and the drainages are estimated to be maybe 18 to 20,000 years, and the shortest on the order of I think, 5 to 6,000 years. So these are mainly Holocene age systems. And then we can use that relationship to predict clay content and the mass of clay per unit area. So we can start to map out the distribution of soil properties completely independent of the soil data. We chose this site because we just happen to have all of these soil pits that were sampled. And then we can compare our prediction with that is actually measured. And for the majority of sites, we see actually a very good relationship between the predicted and the measured. There are a number of sites that fall off of this line. And when we look at these data, these are also locations where the geomorphic model predicting soil depth failed. And so there's a variation in parent material and other landscape controls not captured in the geomorphic model that's leading to some of this, the error in that prediction. And so just to kind of summarize the evolution of this and where it's going is that what this has highlighted is that the central production of primary production and available water. So this is nothing new, but we provided this unit that we can integrate both of those into this EEMT term as a predictive variable for predicting the energy available to drive soil evolution. So again, we're not predicting any process. We're comparing this energy rate to the net effect of all the processes that have occurred over the evolution of that soil system. And that it's clear that, you know, to work at landscape scales, you have to take into consideration, again, this is nothing new and exciting, but we can explicitly show that variation in topography, and particularly aspect and local insolation, is key to accurately estimating energy and mass flux. And that we can now start to play games where we can, in model space, start to incorporate these two terms and bring together numerical modeling approaches from the geomorphic community with this more kind of traditional soil science approach of energy and mass flux, and start to make estimates of what that landscape evolution and how that would take place. And so again, ignoring the processes, but we can hopefully use this to inform the processes that are going on. And so I think that was it. Stop there. Thanks. Yeah, so what I did is I went through and I think I used ammonium nitrate for a typical fertilizer rate application rate. And so calculated essentially the geochemical energy associated with that component and the rate, and got an estimate of that energy input through just that one example of kind of a just to get some quantification of where it would fall in terms of those other parameters. Well, I mean, we could, again, with the test where we did it completely independent of soil data on the relatively high, you know, a small catchment, we're talking 10 hectares. How well, the next step would be is that can we actually go from that scale and try to scale it up to larger landscapes? There are new data products now. One of the colleagues that does the geomorphic modeling has produced a map for much of the globe to be used in land surface models of soil depth, based on some of these geomorphic transport laws. So we'd have that first constraint. Residence time is the hardest thing to constrain. You can get at it. You can wave your hands a bit through some of the erosion rates and depths and make some estimates on how long that sediment's been sitting there. But that's kind of the weak link right now, is getting good constraint on landscape age. But it'd be great to try and apply this to other areas. One of the slides I didn't put in here is we applied it to catchments within the that had data, actually including the Frogs Hollow site that, that Kyung-Soo talked about earlier, and several of the critical zone observatory catchments where there's good constraint, either via uranium isotopes or cosmogenic nuclides on age and different landscapes and complex topography. And we see decent, we see much the same kind of correlation between our predicted values and the actual measured values. And these are from stuff on schist in humid temperate systems to stuff on, you know, semi-arid systems. So there is some suggestion that we can apply it outside, but again, we'd have to, it has to be validated every time you do it. So that was a long roundabout answer.
Thanks.